Well, it is a huge pleasure to interview Professor Paul Badham for my latest Nostalgia podcast. And Paul, now, you were one of my very first tutors 33 years ago when I went to what was in those days Sir David's University College, Lampeter. But of course, your time at Lampeter, I think, am I right in thinking, goes back to the middle of the 1970s?
Back to 73.
Oh, the year I was born.
Yes. And I'd always known about Lampeter because my father went to Lampeter, and so after my appointment, I didn't have to go find some Atlas.
well, many people have done, of course, just to get... When you're in Lampeter, you don't need an Atlas to find your way around. But getting there in the first place, actually... some people don't even give up. They get as far as Carmarthen and then give up. So your father, did he do theology there at Lampeter?
No, he did English. Oh. But he did a degree in theology later at Oxford. Yeah. As a number of people have done. In those days, it was often a first degree that people did then.
And I think you've quoted your father in one of your books. Is it Leslie Badham?
Yes.
Yes, you've definitely mentioned him, and I'm trying to think what the link was, but I think you referred to some influence that he had on what you worked on subsequently.
Yes, and that was in both directions, because there was a clergyman in London who left his entire estate so that all future clergy should have a copy of my father's book. And when this was first mooted, it was suggested, my father suggested, that I should update it every time so that it would continue to be relevant. And that has happened, except that now, this year, I've passed the responsibility for editing to the research lot at the Church of England.
Yeah. Wonderful, because now that you mention that, I think you told us that as an undergraduate. Maybe it would have been like a modern theology module, and you talked about the sustaining relevance of your father's work. So that's right. So you were always updating it and making sure that it was relevant.
Yes. Its main theme was that Jesus was unique in his influence across time. And that in so many subject areas, you find people quoting Jesus. No one has been more quoted. And that's very interesting, because it leads one to wonder how on earth did he get this influence? What aspects, what brought this about? Why was he the most influential man in history when he didn't conquer any countries or do other things that people get remembered for?
Well, it's funny you say that, because a quote has come to my mind, and it's worth saying, of course, that your legacy has followed me all the way to Canterbury, where I live and work at the moment, because I teach a course on death and the afterlife. And as you would imagine, a few books you might recognise: Immortality or Extinction, Christian Beliefs About Life After Death, and so on. And so the students all know your examples. But that one of the ones that we always use, and I use with my film work as well, is that notion of resurrection, present experience, and it's not just an historical event 2,000 years ago. There has to be contemporary relevance. So your work has been very influential for me in a lot of the film work with biblical epics that I look at as well. So it's interesting that came from your father, and then obviously that ended up being very key to your own theological journey.
Yeah. One thing, I got interested in life after death for the rather perverse reason that I had done 2 degrees in theology and trained for the Christian ministry without at any time being asked to write an essay on the topic of death and immortality. And I knew that this was central to a Christianity for most of its history, that it's a relatively low-key subject today, but it never was before. And so I wanted to find out more about it. I wrote my PhD thesis originally on the concept of the soul. And I was unbelievably lucky in that Sir John Eccles had read my book, because he was giving a series of lectures on the brain and mind. and he'd read my book and then invited me to a conference in Los Angeles on it, on the brain-mind problem. And since he just got a Nobel Prize for his experimental studies of the brain, and he was a controversial figure at the time, because when a number of philosophers were saying that...
mind was just an aspect of the brain.
Well, Eccles responded to the claim that, to that claim by saying that people, some people refer to a ghost in the machine.
Yeah.
Actually, a ghost in the machine is just precisely the sort of thing, a machine is precisely the sort of thing a ghost could operate.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, because you did all this before your PhD, or around the time, or indeed of, you know, in your PhD, but it was in that very period, wasn't it, mid-70s, that Raymond Moody, Kenneth Ring, all the empirical work on life after death was published. So you'd sort of had the theory in place before the empirical stuff came out. But I remember in your Immortality or Extinction, you then drawing on that very testimony that hadn't been there. Am I right in your original research?
No, it hadn't. That's right. It was a new additional topic. And Dr. Sartori, who you have interviewed on this before, she had the marvellous idea that we could actually test the truth of NDEs by seeing if anyone noticed the symbols she had put around her at the intensive care unit for which she was responsible at Morriston Hospital in Swansea. Yeah. And it was a great disappointment to me and to her that nobody ever did mention these things, because it does cast doubt on the whole thing. I mean, you set up something to check. And if nobody refers to it in a 5-year period, then it doesn't, then it's not true. And however, I reassured her that falsification of an idea was just as valuable for a PhD, but not, of course, for belief in near-death experiences.
Yeah. Well, I mean, her work is extraordinary, isn't it? Because she did that PhD and was actually doing that practical work as a nurse, and was quite emotionally affected by the testimony of patients. But she said that her nurse training didn't allow her to deal with that more personal side, let alone issues around survival or anything that we would obviously call eschatological. But then she did the PhD and found that it was this perfect sort of synthesis, and actually had the means to be able to carry out those experiments that, when I was taught by you all those years ago, of course, you talk about, but she actually had the chance to witness them, to facilitate them through her work as a nurse.
That's right. That was very useful.
Yeah, and you've supervised other projects in this area, I'm imagining, over the years.
Yes, two spring to mind, who argued that NDEs are the basis for religious belief in an afterlife. That the reason people came to believe in an afterlife was that they had, some members of their group had had a near-death experience, and that persuaded them. It predated the religious belief. I'm thinking now of Gregory Shushan.
Yes. Oh, we interviewed him as well.
Have you? Oh, yeah. That's great. Yeah.
He was in Portugal at the time, as I believe, yes. So, and I use these with my students as well.
That's great. Well, it's interesting. So it means that, as it were, my work has permeated further in the sense that people who've done PhDs with me have then gone on to do work themselves.
Yeah. And very much, you know, keeping that particular, you know, candle burning bright. And I was just thinking, actually, that the amount of publicity that this has generated, even my own students, we use something by Susan Blackmore, of course, who I suppose was the Dawkins of the 1980s, with the very sort of materialist sort of position. And I have to say that the students always gravitate towards the way that you presented this, with the possibility of survival rather than the idea this might not be the case. We have a lot of sceptics in the room, lots of atheists, but I think it's always that thing about wanting to at least be open to the possibility that there might be something that academic work can facilitate. You know, I always find that students who are in the room, sometimes they're there to get their credit, they get there to get their degree, they forget as soon as they've left the room maybe what they've studied. But there are always a few, and we've mentioned a few of them so far, for whom this is a project that is well worth taking outside of the academy and intersects with the lives of real people, very much, yes, you know, away from the ivory tower dimension. So that must have been a real incentive for you.
It was, yes, yes. One thing that leads to another. I had actually five Canadian students who wanted to research originally what NDEs were all about, but ended up doing work on the care of the dying. And that was interesting because they were all five of them were nurses in Toronto. And they also encouraged me to develop change my emphasis from working on near-death experiences to working on caring for the dying and the most appropriate care for the dying. And that led to my book on Is There a Christian Case for Assisted Dying, which we learned yesterday the Scottish Parliament is going to vote for. And if the opinion polls tie in with what people vote for, then Scotland would have it. And that would be a very interesting development. I have been for some time a patron of Dignity in Dying, and my book on Is There a Christian Case for Assisted Dying has helped that debate in the sense that George Carey wrote to me and said, having read my book, I've changed my mind.
Really?
And I shall do all I can to forward it. And the Archbishop of Cape Town, former one, Desmond Tutu and George Carey, and Rabbi Romaine, are three people who have patrons of religious attitudes to. And I'm just very pleased that there are so many people now who are doing it. Because they can no longer say it's not a good religious belief. Yeah. Once you get an archbishop, two archbishops saying it is. Yeah.
So the afterlife has afterlife. And I was just thinking of this, actually, because The you mentioned obviously what's going on in Scotland and Esther Ranson, of course, who was a real champion for this. And I remember, I mentioned this just before we started the recording, it would have been in 1994, possibly early 95, when I was doing the MA with you in death, yes, and immortality. And you went on one of her, she used to have like a weekday afternoon show, I think it was on BBC Two, and they were looking at near-death experiences. And you told us that you were going to be on it, but you were aware that you'd only had like, you know, 20 seconds or so. You were there as the expert, but it obviously wasn't there for an academic audience. But did you get a lot of those sort of invitations? Because I always used to see you used to show us videos of the various near-death experience, particularly in those more embryonic years when it was, you know, only becoming sort of fashionable. You did a lot of media work, didn't you, in those days?
I did, and attended conferences. But I have a marginal regret nowadays that so much of my academic life was tied in with this sort of work, because I have always been interested across the whole field of Christian theology and beyond. Yeah. And I would mention the and beyond because the study of world religion has always been a topic of great interest to me.
Because you've done a lot of stuff on religious pluralism, for example, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I did a dissertation with you. This is all flooding back to me now on Rudolf Bultmann, demythologization. So, you know, you taught so much in this area of Christian theology, and it could be argued that the module that I teach at Kent called Death of God owes significantly to a module on modern Christian theology that I did with you in 1992. I hope you don't have the patent for it, because I've mercilessly paraphrased from that module, looking at all the various key thinkers. And of course, John Hick. Now, we have to talk about John Hick, who mentions you in his autobiography. I remember he mentioned there were a couple of his PhD students who went on to greater and wonderful things, and perhaps some who didn't. But he singled you out. I think there was one other as well. And of course, through you, I had the privilege many times of meeting John Hick. In fact, you ran I think he was doing one of his talks on is there one way to God, or multiple ways to God, but the sort of multiple pathways, but one destination. And this would have been around November 1992. And you were going to be delivering that lecture anyway. I think it was like a Tuesday afternoon. But you said that week's lecture would be done by John Hick. And it was in the Canterbury building, as I remember. And it was full of so many colleagues, David Coburn, who's with us today as well. And it was absolutely packed out. So that was a real draw. But am I right in thinking that John Hick was your own PhD supervisor?
He was my own PhD supervisor. And he very kindly, regularly invited me to Claremont. Every February, there was a conference in Claremont in our midway winter, and it was a great privilege to go there. And he always got very interesting other people along. So I was very happy about that. I did edit a John Hick reader. And some people had confided in me that they found it helpful to them because they read that before they read any of the book.
Yeah.
And also John Hick's translator initially translated a paper I gave in China on John Hick's theology. So that was interesting.
I remember that came out. Would that have been around 1991?
Yeah,
that, I remember. That came out while you were teaching me as an undergraduate.
Right. Yeah.
So he's had a seminal influence on your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what I should have said there was that actually the person who translated all John Hick's books, the first thing he translated was my summary. So that he got into John Hick and then translated his other books.
I mean, that sort of legacy of him obviously being influential on you, because I use his Death and Eternal Life with the students, and of course he was making a case in the 70s when that first edition came out for looking at mediumship, looking at issues around telepathy, the sort of thing that in its day was always seen to be a little kind of more peripheral, a bit more marginal, but he brought that very firmly into the scholarly domain, didn't he?
He did. He made it respectable to talk about it. Though you have to be careful here. It's not really all that respectable.
Well, this is an interesting one, because, of course, I did all my training in Lampeter. And of course, I disseminate all of that with my own students. So, of course, I've always sort of championed that. But I've championed it because you championed it, and you championed it because John Hick championed it. But actually, I've kind of brushed away, perhaps, because, I say to the students, we discuss this very thing. Is this academically respectable stuff? And the students are like, well, yeah, this is important. It's sort of real-world stuff. But it's grounded. This is the crucial bit. It's grounded in all the other theological musings and epiphanies and that you're involved with. So it's very much grounded in very respectable theology rather than sort of something that is an outlier.
Yes. Though I remember Francis Crick saying, "What you believe, what everyone believed yesterday, and you believe today, only cranks will believe tomorrow."
I kind of wish it was the other way around. That it was the cranks of yesteryear who were proven wrong. But moving on swiftly, no. And also, yes, interesting, because I did a class on mind-dependent worlds as well, and we were looking at the differences, the social world versus the individual, more solipsistic landscape that you've championed. So your legacy, I don't know if you're aware of it, but certainly your work is hugely taken on board by certainly my own students, and I'm very sure the same for those other individuals that we've mentioned. Paul Hedges is another one who, of course, have very much stayed within academia.
Yeah, and I think it's not only that goes in all directions, doesn't it? I mean, the fact that Sir John Eccles was a dualist,
yeah,
and the world's greatest neuroscientist was very important,
yes,
for me. It was something I could always appeal to when people suggested that this was not tenable.
That's true, because H.H. Price, of course, was Welsh, but also he was a very respectable philosopher as well as somebody who worked in the field of the parapsychology.
Yes,
so it was that twinning.
Yes, and C.D. Broad made it also to make it respectable.
Yeah. Just asking as well, because did you see this evolution over the years that while you were at Lampeter, because obviously the people came to Lampeter to do PhDs with you because of your work in this area, but did you kind of feel that you were always on the defensive? Did you kind of, or did it not bother you anymore? Was there that sense that you knew that this was intellectually respectable, but or was there a sense over the years that you were always having to sort of prove your case?
Well, yes, up to a point. I knew that my work wasn't very respectable. After all, I had discussed it with David, who's with us here now, and with my wife, who did a peer PhD on the emergence of life and mind from a materialist perspective. And I remember that David's predecessor, Bob Sharp, once told me, "I hope you realise, Paul, that if your thesis is right, if Linda's thesis is right, your thesis is right." So we did a book together.
Yeah. Immortality or extinction. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Wonderful.
And I think it was a much better book because it represented the case both sides with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And I think that helped our teaching of philosophy of religion at Lampeter, that David could defend a non-theistic position and I could defend arguments for the existence of God. Talking about arguments for the existence of God, I went to a God conference in Assisi once where a number of distinguished Muslim students, professors, came. And after the conference, or towards the end of the conference, I was asked by one of them, people there responsible for university work, whether I would be interested in a chair in Abrahamic religions, which I wouldn't, I'm not linguistic enough to do that. But he subsequently funded three students with PhD funding to come to Lampeter and work on the arguments for existence of God with me. And so, I don't know if you remember them.
Well, when was I there? 91 to 2001.
Oh, well, there would have been. Because there was over a six-year period, there were always some PhD students from Turkey. And
yes,
one of them went back to become dean of the Faculty of Philosophy. Oh,
Muhsin Akbas.
Muhsin Akbas is the one whose work I was trying to remember.
Yes.
And another. I always consoled myself in thinking of you mentioning how one thing can influence another. Hans Kuhn mentions in one book that Thomas Aquinas always wrote with the writings of the great Islamic philosophers on his desk, And I sometimes quoted that to feel that with four of us there, three studying the arguments for the existence of God, was doing what Aquinas had done so perfectly so many centuries earlier.
I'm going to pay you a very huge compliment now, because as you're talking, what I remember everybody, whenever your name comes up, what everybody says is that it was the accessibility of your work, the way you presented it, that the real charisma with which it was presented. We were all spellbound by that. You know, we'd be writing our essays and you know, we knew exactly where you stood on an issue, but you were also very fair and respectful to those other positions. You know, you'd always present the alternative case. Even, I think, when I was, would have been November 92, on the day we had a modern theology class with you, it was the ordination of women priests, when that was authorised by the Church of England, and I think we were all watching it on the telly, or we sort of talking about it the next day. So again, all these really big live issues where you had very clear thoughts, and actually in many ways I'd say ahead of your time, because you were very clearly an advocate of that at a time when it took the church many, many years, even decades, to sort of get to the position where you always were.
Yes. My wife actually wrote the document for the Modern Churchmen's Union on the case for the ordination of women, which I was very pleased about.
Where in the country were you born? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Chiltern village, where with the Norman church, where my father was the vicar. He understood, or rather, in fact, the rector, must get these things right. And he belonged to the kind of school which thought that a clergyman's job was essentially to teach theology to the ordinary people. And so that I grew up thinking that theology mattered and it was important, and that I wanted to be a clergyman in this kind of way.
So you knew from a young age that this was what you wanted to do?
Yes, and I thought it was a very effective job to do and worth doing. And I recognised the place my father held in the village as rector. Of course, things are very different nowadays. It was, in some ways, I think I grew up into a different world. Mm. It's not like that nowadays. Anyway, in pursuit of my interest in theology, I did scripture at A level, and then I went up to Oxford, where I did a degree in theology, which was a very old-fashioned kind of degree in the sense that it concentrated entirely on biblical and patristic theology. I knew things about Christianity 2451. Yes. And it seemed to me it was bizarre to stop there. Yeah. I mean, I knew why we stopped there, but it seemed odd. And there was nothing to do with any other religion or indeed with a critique of Christianity. So it was different from the sort of thing that people expect a degree to contain. I thought of that later when I was asked by the QAA to help contribute to the definition of a degree in theology or religious studies, which was an interesting phenomenon. Yeah. And interesting that in the end, theology and religious studies agreed that the QAA could treat us as the same subject with the same parameters. And that was that wouldn't have happened in the past, and it didn't happen in subjects like sociology and anthropology, which insisted on having their own specifications given by the QAA.
So obviously you were teaching theology over many years. Did you find in the course of teaching that all of these definitions, all these changes were around and that you were responding to them, and that the students also reflected sort of a new generation, a new set of generations in what they were bringing to the university?
Yes, I think we were part of a national mood. And it's hard to think, as it were, that religious studies at Lancaster was at one point the only university offering religious studies, although it was studied elsewhere under the headings of anthropology or sociology. But it was distinctive when it was done in conjunction with theology. And Lampeter was very much part of that conjunction. And I did feel that we had an impact on society and were reflecting changes as well as initiating them. And after I'd done my degree in Oxford, I decided to do a second first degree by doing a new course at Cambridge, which was on Christian theology in the modern world. It was very difficult to do this course because you could never get funding, but I persuaded my LEA that it was actually, they had some money for making discretionary awards, and so they exercised their discretion to allow me to do this. And I, of the five papers I took, there was one was Christian Thought Since Kant. Another was Church and Society from 1830 to the present day. And another was on colonialism and Christian mission. And another was on Christian attitudes to other faiths. And finally, one on Christian ethics in relation to issues of sex and the family. It struck me that 50 years later, the church is now getting round to these subjects.
So that dispels your earlier claim about the cranks of tomorrow being the orthodoxy of today. So I think you have every right to feel vindicated. What about other interests? Because so obviously we all know you, theology. I always think of you in relation to something that, you know, when I was a student, it was a different generation, really, I suppose. But, you know, we could never believe that our lecturers, our professors would ever be in the supermarket or anything, you know, have normal lives. There was always that sort of mystique around academia, because I went into that profession myself. But what about sort of wider interests, music maybe? A lot of films have been made about near-death experiences, and I think you used to watch them, or at least you were very aware of them. But I'm just sort of interested in the way that might have impacted on your journey as well.
I think music impacted on my journey and my life. I met my wife when we were both at Birmingham singing Tallis's 40-part motet, which I think the professor of music there, Ivor Keyes, I think his name must have had something to do with his career. He wanted to show that an undergraduate choir could actually do Tallis's 40-part motet. Subsequently, it's become a sort of kind of test that lots of amateur societies give themselves. But I've always been a member of a choir, right back to the age of seven. And it's been very good, because so much of the world's music has been written on religious themes. And religious experience is one of the triggers. Music is one of the triggers for religious experience.
So is that something that you've always sort of been interested in? It sounds as though it's very much complemented your academic work. So it's always that question, isn't it, about the motivations, what makes us sort of feel that this is worth getting up in the morning? What's the passion behind what are the drivers behind what we do?
Well, music is a driver to do things. I mean, it seems to me almost that so many people I know who are interested in religion, sometimes not believing themselves, but are interested in the music which the church... I think you might think yourself in that position, David, as someone who likes music, especially church music.
Yes, it is true. Yes, church music probably is my favourite, but not because of any belief.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's funny because when I did because I did the Masters with you in the mid-90s, on death and immortality. And then I wrote a book some years later looking at those very arguments, but film as another conversational partner. And what we found, and what I find with my students when we're discussing this, is the way that there's this real eclecticism from filmmakers who are happy to have a character going to heaven but then they're reincarnated as if somehow heaven is too static, too dull, too inane almost as a sort of as a point, and that there needs to be something earthly, there needs to be something terrestrial afterwards to follow. So it's a mishmash of traditions that you'd never get away with. There's no obvious sort of theological position that's being drawn on. Maybe, you know, Geddes McGregor, I suppose, who sort of, you know, has tried to sort of fuse all these different, you know, traditions. But I found that so interesting because it's like filmmakers have been driving so many of these debates, you know, Flatliners or What Dreams May Come and another film, Ghost, or, you know, some of those films that you've probably come across.
Well, no, I was interested to read your thesis and of course, to pass it. because I think that the ways in which people are influenced by religious ideas is an intriguing fact about life. Do you know Tom Holland, who sort of pioneered these podcasts? His book, Dominion, argues that Western civilization isn't understandable without Christianity.
You mentioned podcasts. Is that something that you would yourself listen to these days? Is that the way that you follow through on a lot of these trends and debates?
Well, yes, partly because I find that now that I'm so ill, I can be read to by reading podcasts. And that's great.
Yeah.
I also, the last big research project I did was on comparing religious experience in Britain and China, which I did with my then colleague at Lampeter, St. John Yao, who has gone back, by the way, to being dean of the Faculty of Philosophy at the People's University, which is a remarkable thing. Because he came to Lampeter originally because he couldn't study religion properly in China, whereas now he can.
Yes.
And that's intriguing. And the other thing is that the research project I was on religious experience, I compared the work of the Alistair Hardy Society, what they'd found out about religious experience, with religious experience in China. And the Templeton Foundation gave us $1 million to do this, $1 million to do this research, where we had people from the People's University conducting the research project, asking the questions. It was very difficult to find what questions to ask. Over and over again, we had to hand back drafts, because when we translated back from Chinese into English, it wasn't the same as we had intended to ask. And so back translation formed a useful test on this thing. And one of the most interesting things that we found was the influence of Christianity in China. Only 3% of Chinese would claim to be Christian. Only 3%. Mm. But 11% said that they liked to follow the way, thought they ought to follow the way of the Christian God. Now, I think that's extraordinary, those two findings. Oh, and 25% of Chinese declared themselves to be firm atheists. It's actually the same number as seeing Britain, despite many having very different approaches. I mean, until recently, Christianity has been normative in Britain. Not normative, but there's something that everybody assumes is part of the culture. Whereas in China, that was certainly not true. But it nevertheless, I don't think we would have, if we could repeat this thing, I don't think in England and Wales, I don't think we would find that 11% wanted to, ticked a box to say that they thought they should follow the way of the Christian God.
So it's findings like that that obviously have, you know, corroborated and clearly infused you, because, you know, you're finding all these sort of threads and patterns on a very global scale, not, you know, so yeah. Your work has clearly transcended particular, like, Anglican traditions. But that leads me on to my next point, because you obviously were ordained, weren't you? So
yes.
you're in the Church of England.
Yes.
And was that the original, you know, career? Was that the calling? Did you ever imagine or expect that the academic work would be what has sort of taken over? Did you originally imagine that you'd have a parish and that would be your work, or did you always see the two as working in tandem?
I always believed that the work of a clergyman ought to be the study of and teaching of Christian theology. That was what clergy were for. I don't think that all clergy today think that. They like to do social work. But I grew up not thinking these were alternatives in the way that a person might think that today. I mean, a person... I found it intriguing in a survey I did once that most people doing in academic theology who were older than me were ordained, and those who were younger than me were not. And I think that is the case today. Well, one thing that I wanted to do at Lampeter was to try and move away from the idea that Christianity should be taught by believers only, and other religions should be taught by atheists who are interested in religious studies. And I thought this was profoundly wrong, and at Lampeter, I always tried to ensure that we could try and recruit people who were either believers themselves or who were culturally conscious of the influence of their own faith. For example, whereas we had a rabbi who was a professor of Judaism, we had a lecturer in Hinduism who, while not being a believer herself, had taken 4 degrees, 4 first-class degrees in the University of Delhi, and therefore had to know about Hinduism from within.
May a warrior.
Within. Yes. And of course, Sinjin Yao, who edited the Encyclopedia of Confucianism, taught Chinese religion for us. So that in Islam, we at one point had 3 lecturers who were Muslims. And so the world faiths were being taught in Lampeter from within, as well as in religious studies, from without. And it seems to be both perspectives are needed. And so the theologians should know something about world religion.
Yeah, no, and that's really insightful, because there were many people, myself included, who took a theology route. Not necessarily, I mean, I suppose my background is in Anglicanism, but I think it was, you know, our driver, and certainly speaking for myself, was not going in there with a very clear faith position. It was more that these were the most important questions, and it was a privilege to be taught by those who did and didn't have faith, and sort of seeing what sort of outcomes there were, to see how we all engage with these great scholarly questions where belief was on the table, but in a way that felt that all possible positions were represented, and which reflected also the mindset of the students, some who had a faith, some who didn't. But yeah, I followed a theology path. I didn't really do that much in religious studies, because in later years through my teaching that has been the case. But did you always feel that maybe there was potentially a tension between those, or did you sort of feel that you were able to accommodate both of those very respectable traditions?
I always thought that people who try to study religious studies often didn't take seriously the divine dimension of belief in some other faiths, particularly in Japanese religion. Eons ago in the unremembered past, Amida Buddha became incarnate to bring salvation to us. Now, it seems to me that is a remarkable statement. It could be a summary of a Christian creed. And yet it isn't. It's a Pure Land Buddhist theme. And I remember when I went to Japan, I went on five occasions to Japan to lecture at Center for Buddhist Studies in Tokyo. And I had a lot of discussions there with the Supreme Primate, who was very interested in the relationship between Christianity. To launch my research project on religious experience, I had originally asked the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, yeah, had originally agreed to be the guest speaker at AMCU conference on religious experience. But when he became Archbishop of Canterbury, he found he was too busy to come. So I asked the Supreme Primate of the Buddhists in Japan if he would like to come and give a paper to the conference, which he had agreed to do. Though he had, of course, changed not on God, but on experiencing other power. But what he said about the other power could correspond to what the other lecturers at the conference were saying about God. And I thought that was, I found that absolutely fascinating. In discussions with him, he said, I think that we're 90% the same. That was not done by any survey, it was just an intuition. And I have no idea whether, how far that would be accepted by others. Though interestingly, when Francis Xavier went to Japan, he looked at Pure Land Buddhism and thought, well, the Lutherans must have got here first. For which, by the way, there is no evidence. It's just that two different cultures had come to similar conclusions.
And did you find that when you were having conversations with colleagues, obviously David's here and you know, your colleagues in religious studies, did you kind of feel departmentally that there were, I was about to use the word synthesis, and that's actually not the right word at all, because there's absolutely no reason why, you know, all the different approaches and traditions have their own, and rightly so, their own respectful, you know, point of reference and their particularity. But did you feel that these sort of conversations were always very open? Did you sort of change your thinking through what others had to bring? Did you feel that other people changed their thinking or were more receptive, perhaps is a better way of putting it, through your own insights along the lines of what you've just been describing?
I found it very interesting that we could always have friendly talks with each other. And that was certainly true also on the with the three Islamic lecturers, that they were all very sympathetic to the study of other religions and were quite prepared to collaborate and cooperate in this. And as far as Christian theology was concerned, it was always a help to us that our New Testament professor, D.B. Davis, was very sympathetic to the idea of us moving in the direction of religious studies and took on a tremendous burden of work in order that we could appoint people in those, in the areas of other religions. Because when I arrived in Lampeter, everyone was a Christian theologian.
Do you have very fond, you know, looking back, was there a particular almost golden age? In all the years you were there, did you kind of feel that there were particular periods when things were really kind of in sync? Did you kind of feel that, you know, in terms of student engagement, student numbers, in terms of you being able to facilitate the sort of research and teaching that you wanted to do? You were there for many, many years. Did you kind of feel that, you know, because you never left. And in that sense, you know, you were embedded in the place. We always associated you particularly with Lampeter. But was there a golden age at Lampeter?
For me, there was a golden age at Lampeter. I would have to look up dates to. I couldn't now give an immediate response. I'd have to find out. When I arrived, when I became head of department, the department consists of 7 people. Mm. And when I resigned as head of department, we were 26. Mm. And we had a million in hand.
Yeah. Well, I saw the pictures not long ago of when the Sheikh Khalifa building was opened, and that would have been in February or March 1998, and I think actually Gary Bunt, who's I think the last surviving member of certainly the team when I was there, I interviewed him in his office in Lampeter just last year. But that was probably around the time when the peak was hit, because then it was a huge department, wasn't it?
It was a huge department, and I think the gift from Sheikh Khalifa for a new building, I think that was probably the peak, the year in which we opened the new building.
Yeah.
And indeed had the Roland Williams building as well as a research project for people who wanted to do research. The combination of the Sheikh Khalifa building, that theology at one stage had two buildings, was interesting. Yeah. One of which was purpose-built.
As we start to wrap up, Paul, because one of the questions I always ask at this point in the interview is about nostalgia and the whole thing about whether your memories are positive, but also what you do with those, because the problem of evil comes up in this context, what you do with those memories that are not so positive. Because from a very superficial level, if you're a student and you're struggling, you've got essays to write, and then, you know, you've all the sort of things you want to do as well as possible, and, you know, if things work out okay, 20, 30 years on, you look back and think, oh, those were wonderful days. But the journey there was often hard. And I've been teaching on Problem of Evil just a week ago with my students on a Philosophy of Religion module at Kent. But I'm always interested in the idea about the way that we reshape the past. And if we do that, and what the goal is, because you're a big sort of teleological thinker, that's sort of the goal, the purpose. You know, is that something that you can apply in your own case? Do you kind of feel, as you look back on your life and career, that there are many ways in which you can say that, yeah, it all worked out okay, that you can be very happy, perhaps, with the way things unfolded over those decades?
Yes, but happy that things unfolded up to perhaps the time when we did, when the Sheikh Khalifa building was opened. I mean, I think in a sense that was the golden age, where theology was flourishing and helping other departments flourish in degree courses like the Victorian age.
Mm. Yes.
And religion and ethics in Western thought.
Yeah.
And I think those things which enabled theology to collaborate with other subjects. Yeah. That was good. Yeah. And I've always been grateful that I collaborated with David on Philosophy of Religion and the MA in Death and Immortality, so that there was always another perspective available.
Did you think, because you obviously spent many years in Lampeter, would a younger version of yourself have been surprised to find out how things fell into place for you? Is this what you expect? You know, obviously a very reputable professor of theology. Is that what you could have imagined doing when you first went to Oxford in your teens?
I think one important year in my life was when a chair came up at Durham University, which I went for, and I was asked in the interview, was there anything any development that you would particularly favour? And I said, I'd like to introduce religious studies. And the chairman of the appointing committee said to me, that would be strongly resisted here. Well, I didn't get the job.
Yeah.
But that prompted me, together with the suggestion that I might move to America, was that I should develop, that Lampeter would actually offer more development opportunities for developing, because we could get things passed through the Senate readily. And other universities seemed to take ages to make decisions, whereas in Lampeter we were allowed to make decisions quickly.
Yeah.
And where there was a favourable to theology, religious studies, ethos where if you could provide the money, you could get the job done. So the fact that we were able to have a large number of PhD students and grants helped us enormously. And we got the benefit of that. Oh, I should have mentioned that we did have a grant from the European Commission to help the Institute for Scientific Atheism at St. Peter's at Leningrad to turn itself into the Institute for Religion in St. Petersburg. And four staff came to Lampeter for some time. Well, four of them were with us for a term. Yes, and so that research project was important to us as a department.
Because I think the Alistair Hardy Centre moved to the department maybe around the time I just left,
right,
in the early 2000s. I think I could be, maybe it overlapped actually.
Yeah.
But certainly in the later years, I remember when we were in the Sheikh Khalifa building on the top floor, you had all the literature. I was just going to ask whether you're still in touch with, or have been in touch. Obviously, David is here with us today, but you've obviously built up so many friendships, so many good academic partnerships over many years. Do you, have they sustained over the many years?
No. I had anticipated that when I retired, I would come regularly to the weekly seminars with the postgraduates, but those ceased to happen. Mm. And then everybody left. Or I don't know the background to why the department closed down.
Mm.
It seemed I was always used to it when as a flourishing department.
Yeah.
And it was on the up all the time I was there.
Would you consider yourself, Paul, to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
I would say that I was, for most of my life, I was a looking forward person with all sorts of plans for the future. Obviously, now that I've got a terminal illness, I don't carry on looking forward. Though I do find that looking at the past is fun as well. And I find that too when I have, I still get all sorts of brochures for nice holidays abroad and cruises and things like that. And I find great pleasure looking through them, even though I know I will never go on a cruise again. But you can get pleasure from the past as well. And so I'm very glad that I did what I did at Lampeter. And I'm just sorry it hasn't carried on. Because one is affected by it not carrying on.
Paul, it has been an immense pleasure to catch up with you again after so many years. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this nostalgia interview with me.
Well, thank you, and thank David for setting the whole thing up.